the unknown.
Mystery.
Space.
Science.
Have fun.
Adventure.
Suspense.
Fantasy.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
Welcome to Journey number 188 of the Journey Into podcast, featuring Leviathan 99 by Ray Bradbury, as presented by the BBC. I am your guide on this journey, Marshall Latham, coming to you from base camp in the Treasure Valley. It's great to be back here for another journey here on the Journey Into podcast. It's what I started out doing, right? These journeys, whether it was old-time radio shows or whether it was full-cast audio, short stories, whatever it was. As of late, it's been more old-time radio, but I definitely still enjoy going back and listening to these great audio classics. And I think it's a lot of fun to see the differences in media from this time. And these old-time radio shows, to me, just kind of have a romantic quality to them. I know I don't always go back to the 40s and 50s. That's kind of when radio was in its heyday. 30s, I guess, or the late 30s as well. But 40s and 50s, for sure, was the golden age of radio. And sometimes, you know, I play things from a more modern radio or even internet productions. And I think these are fun as well. But you can't get more of a classic tale than Moby Dick from Herman Melville. Ray Bradbury wrote the screenplay for the movie from 1956 that was directed by John Huston and stars Gregory Peck. I remember watching that movie, you know, some of the characters and the scenes I remember pretty vividly, but it's been a long time since I've watched that movie, and I've never read the book, the actual book of Moby Dick. It was never assigned to me in high school, which, you know, I've read books that I wasn't assigned in high school, but, you know, some of those classics you would catch in a high school assignment type of reading. So yeah, someday maybe I'll actually read the book. You know, it's one of those books and stories that people know the essence of just because it's a big part of pop culture and the references to Captain Ahab going after his white whale and all that kind of stuff is just part of the public consciousness, whether they've read the book or seen the movie or whatever else. You know, they might not know anything, but they know the basic premise of Moby Dick because it's just part of us. It's part of our culture, right? At least here in America, but I would assume other parts of the world. I've always been a fan of Ray Bradbury. My very first podcast episode was an adaptation of a Ray Bradbury story called The Zero Hour. And I've always made him a part of the show. So I wanted to do another Ray Bradbury story, but I thought I'd let my Patreon members decide old-time radio show that I would present here. And so I gave them four options, Leviathan 99 being one of them. My other options on there were I Sing the Body Electric, which was presented by the Twilight Zone radio folks. You know, I just ran The Living Doll a while back, and there's all kinds of Twilight Zone episode radio or internet, I guess I should say, episodes out there. And I like those. So I Sing the Body Electric was one of those. The other Ray Bradbury story was The Screaming Woman, that was presented by Suspense. And I think I'm going to save that for our November because it's got a little Thanksgiving theme, sort of. And the last option that I put out there for them was an adaptation of The Ravine, which was put out by the Bradbury 13 broadcast. Of course, we know what they chose. It was Leviathan 99. And so it's time to present that to you. This radio drama aired on May 3rd, 1968 on the BBC and stars Christopher Lee as the captain. And just a bit of a warning, you know, this is more of a literary style program. So, you know, it's not the whiz-bang, quick suspense escape type of an adventure kind of thing. It is a little bit slower going, so just wanted to prep you with that. And it's over an hour long, so be patient, enjoy the show, be in an environment where you don't need to rush through it. So please come with me and let's journey into the darkness of space.
It was an experiment that tampered with nature's most basic laws. It went terribly wrong. It was buried 5 miles down. Now, a crew of undersea miners is about to stumble upon this terrifying secret.
Comets are in many ways similar to asteroids. They're roughly hewn chunks of stuff left over from the formation of the solar system. Unlike asteroids, which are mostly rock with a dash of ice and maybe metal, comets are a more balanced mixture of ice and rock. And by ice, I mean frozen water, but also frozen carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, methane, ammonia, things we normally think of as gases on Earth. And by rock, I do mean rocks, but also gravel and dust. In fact, astronomers sometimes call comets dirty snowballs, which isn't a half bad term.
I saw the look on your face when you shot those Borg on the holodeck. You were almost enjoying it.
How dare you?
Oh, come on, Captain. You're not the first man to get a thrill from murdering someone.
I see it all the time.
Get out!
Or what? You'll kill me? Like you killed Ensign Lynch?
There was no way to save him.
You didn't even try. Where was your involved sensibility then?
I don't have time for this.
Oh, hey, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt your little quest. Captain Ahab has to go hunt his whale.
What?
You do have books in the 24th century.
Leviathan 99, a radio drama by Ray Bradbury. Christopher Lee, Robert Edison, Walter Fitzgerald and Dennis Hawthorne, as Ishmael, who tells the story, play the main characters in this radio-dramatic space-age poem, for which Tristram Cary composed and executed electronic music and sounds in stereophony. Ray Bradbury, whose many science fiction novels include Fahrenheit 451, which was filmed, and The Illustrated Man, which is being made into a picture, also wrote the screenplay for John Huston's Moby Dick, which may have given him the impetus to write his radio drama. This is its first production. Leviathan
99, when strange new ships sail toward the stars instead of under them, attack the stars instead of fearing them, a name like Ishmael. Yes, my parents flew with the first brave ones to Mars. Turned less than brave, gone sick for Earth, they went back home. Conceived in that journey, I was born in space. A child so birthed in desolations, homeless between yestermorrow and noon's midnight, must have a proper name. My father knew his Bible and recalled another outcast who wandered dead seas long years before Christ. Am I in so far the only child conceived, fleshed, and delivered forth in space? How better to name me than as my father did, touching the dark warmth where I hid restless in the days before my birth. And he did indeed call me Ishmael. As did my friends, who seeing the stars rise and the deep space in my eyes as we flew kites or sailed our homespun gliders, confessed themselves glad I had been named Wanderer. An aspirant of aerial devotions whose destiny would find him out. Some years ago, I thought I would soar about and see all the seas of wind that roam the world. Whenever it is a damp November in my soul, I know it is high time to take to the sky again. There is a magic in air that pulls all men, and man so drawn floats up with eagle, hawk, firewind, or whispering balloon to test the cloudless winds that circle sweet seas of grass and salt seas of brine, until at last he faces on that greater sea of space with its billionfold of stars. And so on a Saturday, 2099, borne by my own jet-packet power, I duly arrived at the Cape and hung upon the air. A fledgling bird among yet greater birds of fire and steel, and felt the floodgates of the vast and waiting universe swing open in my soul. I went down into town. I discarded my wings and traveled now by moving sidewalk. Into a fort, a metal barracks, a dropping place for tired spacemen. No, a beautiful computerized, quietly programmed and machined Garden of Eden. For you see, a spaceman's hostel must be half into outer space. It is a world between. A chapel, perhaps, where men come to commune with their raw souls, organize their gizzards, prepare their bones to be broken on the great rack of gravity and far traveling. Here, the new altars where we might panoply ourselves in strange new costumes. Take unguents. Genuflect the proper genuflections until the day our souls spoke up. Condition go. I register by pressing my hand to a metal identity plate, which reads my sweaty prints like some modern witch of palmistry to plan my future and choose my roommate by machine. Floor 1, cubicle 9. My roommate's name, Quell. Well, let's look at him. The moving floor glides me past robot museums, where other spacemen, like myself, sit with mechanical Platos and Socrates under a Mediterranean sun. In 100 fantastic new-styled schoolrooms, Electric oracles of Delphi. Robot men, complex as beehives, honeycombed with knowledge, wise as the names they bear. Schweitzer, Huxley, Aristotle, run secret tapes in their oil machinery heads and speak forth truths to listening fools who would be wise. But here's my room. There's my thumbprint on the scanning lock. I hope my roommate is not a huge spider. I do try to like spiders, but... there. The door open. Shut. I am in my room. And there, on the far side, in bed, in the dark, lies a shape hidden. A stranger, the size, shape, color, I can't see. I'm trembling. Perhaps I feel it might be.
A spider?
What?
No spider. No. Put on the light. Well?
Well, you speak, but your mouth doesn't move.
My mind moves. You watch it move with your own mind.
This is my first meeting with a telepath.
And a creature 9 feet tall.
I was wondering where your beanstalk was.
My name is Quell. I come from an island planet many light years away in space. A green world like your own. Which grows, however, animal men which do not look quite right.
Oh, no.
I read your mind. You think I have too many eyes, too many ears, far too many fingers, a greenish skin.
But me, I've only 2 eyes, 2 ears, 5 fingers on each hand. My skin's cheese beside yours.
Well, then, we're both very funny.
And both human.
Yes. But what is human? Size, shape, color? No. An idea. To behave well. Creatures of the sun that we all are, to not give darkness to others. That is human. So, too many eyes have I, too many limbs, too many fingers, too many ears. But still we are the same. Now, Ishmael, shall I grind your bones to make my bread? Or shall we be friends?
Friends. Yes, friends, I think. And friends we were. Two terrible and fine, ugly and beautiful children of nature. For what is nature? Why? God surprised. God continuing to surprise himself with odd miracles of flesh. And there was nothing odder or more miraculous than Ishmael and Quell from the far islands of the great Andromeda Nebula. We lived together, studied together, and, at last, went off to find our rocket together. A great kite and a small. We flew like autumn leaves above the Florida Cape. And from a distance watched the rockets fall up to drown in summer lakes of space. The scars of their traveling soon healed by wind. And below in their towering gantries stood the other ships that sailed for stars. Gemini 97, Star Trek 3... Which will it be, Quell? Choose.
The computers have already chosen for us.
Quell, pretend. Make believe the machines don't run us.
How young you are. There then, choose.
Jupiter 10, Apollo 88.
Hold on. There.
Cetus 7.
Cetus 7.
Do we fly to see her?
We fly! There. Biggest rocket ever built, Cetus.
Sirs.
Yes?
Friends.
We are no friends of yours.
Oh, you're quick to read my mind. Is that your rocket?
It is.
Oh, you tread the rim of the abyss. Pull back.
Ah.
Don't go. You, young one. Listen, do you know that rocket's captain?
Not eye to eye.
Eye to eye. Ah, you've touched the nerve. For when you meet him, do not peer into his eyes. Be warned, he has none.
None? Gone blind?
No, stricken's more the word. Burnt blind in space some years ago. His skin, his mind, his soul, all burnt, but somehow hung together he lives on. But you knew it.
No.
And want no more from you.
No. You've read my mind. Now, tell your friend about your captain. What burnt him blind? Where? When? For what strange reason? Was he a priest of space, run after God, and God turned and gave him darkness from one blow? Is your captain all one piece? Or does it show where he was sewn back up? Does midnight still peek out through holes the doctors couldn't mend? Is he all one scar? Was he born albino? Or did terror color him up and whiten him out like awful snow? No, find. Then turn away. The Cetus is not your ship for space. It's no man save the captain's, and the captain's lost forever. Morning, friends.
Wait, don't fly. What's your name?
Elijah. James Elijah.
The thunder of Elijah's prophecy was lost in the grand thunder of the rocket being tested. The last of a million supplies were going aboard. Oh, the logistics of the rocket. Computerized the decisions going on a billion for each trip. The nursing bottles full of super homogenized gunk for suckling men. Botanical gardens. Rare, small, compacted jungles which inspire bad, suspire good, oxygenated airs. Capsuled ocean seas which grow algae for atmospheres and salads. Machines which spin the sweats of rocket man to fresh new range to be drunk again. Not the Lord's Prayer inscribed on a pin, but whole books stamped on needles whereby to sew up the tears in one's space-worn soul. Strange machines, stranger men. For half our crew were accidents of nature in a baroque humor. That is to say, midgets and dwarves.
We were babes to be cradled in the lap of space. Half size, but cheap at half the price, for each pound of rocket man is worth thousands of dollars. In oxygen, fuel, food, water, living room. So much of our ship was toy cabins with toy people squirrel caged in them.
Years back, dwarves, midgets like us, had short lifespans and poorer health. But now they have put our chromosomes in a vice and compressed us down a healthy cookie-cutout genius, a gargoyle lost from the front porch of Notre Dame. And we small boys, age 30, fresh from the womb that has diminished his cells, journey with your giant six-foot men and make space our incredible toy chest.
So the final burgeoning of the Cetus 7 was with titans and bright child men toddling in their shell. But at no time in all this bustling preparation did any of us see, blind or otherwise, the prophesied captain of our ship. At last, the Cetus 7 stood ready. Nearby upon the Florida sands was a church, a vast place which entered was a replica of deep night and a million stars. No astronaut failed to wander here before his long night in space. Here came Quell and I on a rainy Sunday to find our way among bright tombstone plaques which touched, whispered the fates of lost astronauts and their wandering graves.
Smith, lost near Mars, July 2015.
Traveling graves, yes. What better place to be buried, cast forth on a sea of measureless stars and eternal cold? Such men as spacesuits, both coffin and shroud, stay young forever. Come back a billion years from this noon, and what would you find? Fast frozen, the young man you knew at breakfast 10 million morns lost ago. No worm has touched, no rain destroyed him. All summer flesh, he will circle the sun like a tiny moon, until the last sands have run through the hourglass of creation. Who would not want such graves and the fair cosmetic that space can give? In the pulpit, at the center of the spaceman's chapel, stood a man who had died 100 years ago. Dead, yes, but so remarkable a man was he that they did computerize his soul. That is, they did up his voice on tapes, made circuitries of his merest breath and motion, then locked it all in plastic flesh and steel. So now before us stood Father Ellery Colworth. A monster robot, no. Gentle essence of the man.
Is God dead? An old question now. But once hearing it, I laughed and replied, no, not dead, but simply sleeping till you chattering bores shut up. A better answer is, are you dead? Does the blood move in your hand? Does your hand move to touch metal? Does that metal move to touch space? Do wild thoughts of travel and migration move behind your flesh? They do. You live. Therefore, he lives. You are the thin skin of life upon an unsensing earth. You are that growing edge of God which manifests itself in hungers for space. So much of God lies vibrantly asleep. The very stuffs of worlds and galaxies, they know not themselves. God reaches for the stars. You are his hand. Creation manifests. You go in search. He goes to find. You go to find himself. Everything you find along the way, therefore, it will be holy. On far worlds, you will meet your own flesh, terrifying and strange, but still your own. Treat it well. Beneath the shape, you share the Godhead. You, Jonas, are traveling in the belly of a new-made metal whale, the rocket ship, you swimmers in the far sea of space, blaspheme not against yourselves or the frightening twins of yourselves you find on far worlds, but ask to understand the miracle which is space, time, and life in the high attics and lost birthing places of eternity. Woe to you if you do not find all life most holy. Better than if you stay locked forever in the belly of the rocket like Jonah, never to be vomited out upon dry land.
The thunder of the storm ended the sermon. The thunder of a rocket echoed the storm. And suddenly it was the night before our fall into deep space. In our room, Quell and I lay sleepless, watching the diminishing rain on the great sky windows, listening to the voice clock announce the hours.
Tick, tock, 2 o'clock. Tick, tock, 2 o'clock.
Well, awake?
Part.
The rest of me sleeps well.
How do you do that?
It cannot be taught. Next time you are born, we will arrange it.
That part of you that's away. What are you thinking?
Of our journey. Of that man who warned us.
Elijah, did you believe him?
That the captain is blind? Yes. That he is mad? We must discover that.
But by that time, mightn't it be too late?
Well?
What? All asleep now. All right, friend, lie there. Your body the strange color of a world I'll never see. Your skin tattooed over with signs from the Horsehead Nebula, the Coal Sack Orion, bleached by white suns, burnt by red suns. Cold blood, but warm heart. Your mouth silent, but your mind, even in sleep, breathing friendship.
Ishmael.
Well, thank God for you and the days ahead.
Take off time, sunset at 7:31 hours. At sunset, aboard the rocket, we, the crew, waited. And the sun rose again. That is to say, the gantry elevator bearing one man rose up through the twilight air. And the elevator, rising high and swift, caused the sun, just gone below the earth, for a last moment to reappear. The sun, thus summoned back, played golden light upon this man who came alone and last. But if the sun played upon his face, he did not know nor see. And as for us, we only heard our captain step upon the landing.
That's him, the captain.
He's going direct to his quarters.
Why? He sounds like a robot.
No, idiot. The radar screen all miniaturized. It carries in a mask across his eyes. Blind, but not blind. A sweet machine, that. He...
Four. All on board. Prepare for checkout and countdown.
The blind captain was indeed with us, unseen and locked away. We lay like spiders in our shock absorber webs, waiting for the fire wind to seize and throw us at the sky. And seize and throw it did. And with a long cry, we rose to have our cry cut off. Silence took us like penitent monks to its bosom. For even the loud rocket which rips the soul on earth walks silent. A few miles up, treads the stars without footfall. As if in awe of the great cathedral of space.
Ship's log, Cetus 7, August 2nd, 2099. Out of sight of land. How strange to put it this way, yet true. Out of sight of the blessed land, which means all earth and those we hold dear upon it. All faces, houses, trees, streets, towns, cities, meadows, ocean, seas. Gone. All longitudes, latitudes, meridians, and hours, all nights and days, all time. Yes, time too. Gone. No sunrise, no sunset, no sound, no wind. How lonely. Quell, will we make it back? See Earth again?
Friend, I read minds, not futures.
space is large. They say it curves. Perhaps our end is in our beginning.
Word squad report on the double.
Twenty days. 40 days gone in space. Our destination, a star in Cygnus, about which might roll a planet moist and green as Earth. We could not tell. We only went to see. Traveling up the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, we could reach and return from that far world in 10 years. 10 years. 3,650 days of endless traveling night. And only work could save us from the boredom that slowly slides into moron insanity. Work in the chemistry lab. Work in the compacted jungle swamp which cycled our carbon dioxide and gave us fresh oxygen and green salads for lunch. Work at repairing the ship's skin when rare meteors hit. Work which meant in seconds we must slap the great adhesive patch fast so our air did not rush out and leave us swiftly dead. Work, work, work. And through all the days, our captain stayed unseen within his quarters. His orders came as if delivered from a far place. But sometimes, at 3 in the deep morning, standing watch, I heard the captain pass in the elevator vent like a long-drawn whispering and sigh. Or heard him take the airlock door outside, alone. There to stand sentinel to all space. To walk with magnetic boots upon the sounding flesh of our ship under the stars.
East! There he is!
Again, every midwatch of this hour.
What does he do out there? Play ball with the meteors.
Inhales the infrared, exhales the ultraviolet.
No. He doesn't trust our radars. Even blind, he thinks he sees better.
But what's he looking for?
Quell, you can read his mind. What?
My mind may hear, but the captain's mouth must speak for him. When he finds what he is looking for, he'll let us know.
You read his mind. You don't like what you see. I can tell by your face.
There he goes. Walk, walk, Captain. Stand guard. Protect us from the universe.
Logbook entry. 50 days out from Earth. We...
Young man?
Mr. Redley, sir.
Don't jump, boy. You know, the past 5 minutes you have stared at that door.
Well, sir, the captain's there. I thought 50 days, well, isn't that a long while for him to stay shut in?
Our long is short to him, boy.
Such loneliness would drive me mad.
Yes, well, there are some who savor madness all their days. It is the cud and titbit of their life. They would not know what to do with themselves if they could not nibble round the thin grey circumference of their skull, peeking and gaping from all the sockets, wondering at the cracks, assaying the guilt, rendering out the wonder.
Yes, but does he ever eat?
His soul is marrow enough. Let him feed, boy.
I have this urge to knock upon his door.
Give it a try. No, bang it. There.
Does he never answer,
eh? If he knew God were out there, he might stroll out for a chat, but you or me, boy, do your chores. Do your chores.
Hear this! Hear this!
coming out.
The captain!
Don't stand there, idiot! Line up!
Mr. Ridley, all present, sir. The temperature has gone up 3 degrees in this cabin, all present indeed. Here's one who runs a very furnace of youth. The name?
Sir, Ishmael Honeycutt Jones.
Oh. Isn't that the sound of Blue Ridge Wilderness or the scarred hills of Jerusalem? Now, Ishmael, what do you see that I don't see?
I saw a man tall in stature and tall in years. Not old, but with oldness skinned over him. A prime unprimed by lightnings. His face white, hair white, hands white, uniform white, all everything cut from the same nothings. This was our blind captain who led us toward the stars. Behind his dark Firefly machine radar electric glasses, I knew if I seized them off, I would find eyes the color of minted silver of fish that had been born, lived, and died in the deep night. White, the man was white, all white, to match the whiteness of his much affrighted soul. I felt some years ago the universe had shot off a photographic flash. God blinked and bleached the captain to this color of sleepless nights and lonely terror. His heart did not beat so much as run down eternal panics. Hamlet's father's ghost stood here astride our lives and breathed out further ghosts.
How runs a ship in space, men?
With tight seams and oxygen suits at the ready, sir.
Well said. And how do you treat with the meteor men?
A 5-second patch job and all hands saved, sir.
Then, how do you swallow a flaming comet whole, men? Huh? No answer.
We have not as yet seen comets on the breakfast menu, sir.
You have not.
And then, Captain, mustn't you kill a comet before you can eat it?
True. And they do not make nightly strolls through our basement half of the universe, and yet...
Sir?
They do come by. Ridley.
Sir?
This star chart here, now. You, with good eyes, see. From the region of the Horsehead Nebula, among a billion lights, one special light shows forth. Blind, I feel its spectral presence. Thus. Do I touch the maelstrom, Ridley?
You do.
Closer now. So, not a meteor, a moon, a world. Who'll name it?
Sir, that is a comet.
Comet? No. A vast exhalation of mystery upon the deeps. A pale bride with flowing veil come back to bed her lost unbedded groom. Isn't she lovely, men? A holy terror to the sight.
Captains, is that not the comet which first passed Earth some 30 years ago?
Leviathan.
Speak up.
The comet Leviathan, the largest in history, the...
Leviathan. The great numb terror... The brute chemistry and the universe thrown forth in light and trailing nightmare. Yes. Leviathan.
Was it not Leviathan, Captain, that put out your eyes?
To give me greater visions? Yes. Leviathan, I saw it close. I touched the hem of its great billion-mile-long bridal veil. I circled round the shimmering abyss of snow gone lost in space, and then... That virgin whiteness, jealous of my loving glance, rubbed out my sight 30 years ago. I see it still upon my inner lids, bunked down at night, so passing strange, so full of arctic miracles, that huge white rushing thunderhead of God. It
brought me running. I offered up my fevered soul, all bright. It snuffed me out.
Yet now I rub my bones to kindle me again, for look. Leviathan returns. Now the avalanche of nothingness comes back. For this I seek in space with rocket and with men. As one, we rush to meet that downfell light, which having doomed, now cycles round to doom itself. That cyclops eye long gone deserves a blow. I'll lift my hand, your hands, to make the strike. What? Silence.
They are overwhelmed, sir.
Yes, for ours is a holy mission. There will be none greater in the time of man, though our sands run forever through a glass as big as creation's landfall in far Centauri. Technicians, scan alert! We do not idle by for Leviathan to arrive. We run to catch. Men, it is a long, white, traveling funeral in space. A light that puts out light. Let us slumber it forever. Make it celebrate its own death. Ready the alarms. The first man who scans it in gets double his fees for the journey. Squads, disperse! Fall out!
Now,
is that all you've got to say?
Well, it's not every year a dwarf like me can run hit a giant like Leviathan.
You sound like him.
If it's on our way, what's wrong with sight-glancing a comet 2 falls out of 3?
You don't even know what a comet is.
Ishmael, what did you find in the microfilms?
Same old guff. Photographs of photographs. Interstellar material. Vapors. Meteoroids. So few comets have passed near Earth since we first moved into space in the 1960s. The junkyards would best describe them. Chunks of old solar systems broken off. Accidents of huge nature on the prowl. Well,
in the stories of my people, such comets are known as pilgrim visitors. Far-traveling specters, the haunter of the feast. A collision of bright dreams which fuse to nightmare. You see, our history is as full of romantic nonsense as yours.
Well then, the captain has his reasons for finding the comet and we have ours. We're curious.
Curious, yes. And afraid.
Captain? Captain?
What? Oh. Bedley. I do not sleep, I die. Lord, I dreamt I was falling down space forever, falling. Do you dream, Ridley?
No, sir.
Oh, fortunate man. Well?
Ship's logged to be signed, sir.
I have a fine nose, Ridley. You've no heart for this chase.
If by chase you mean our proper business, charting stars, exploring, well...
No. Here. What do you know of the passage of dark planets and bright comets, mister?
I think you must teach me, sir.
I will. Here are the 1,000 star charts, stamped, runneled, and humped. You read Braille?
Aye.
Run your hand here, there. Touch the paths where the lost suns go. Here, the planetary tracks. And here, upon the universal deeps, the vast long mark of Halley's comet, the comet of Aristophanes, and, who knows, that comet which may well have been the star of Bethlehem, a miracle to celebrate a miracle. Here are the maps and deep night plans for all God's circuitings and maunderings, his long thoughts. God dreams joy, green earths appear. God dreams torments, comets issue from his eyes and mouth,
And the most terrible outcrop of these is...
Leviathan?
From 30 years' study, I found a way to meet it head-on fast, 6 months before it brushes Earth. We move then to surprise.
Surprise?
Mr. Redley, face them out. Well?
You cannot surprise a comet, sir. It neither lives nor cares.
I live. I care.
And shift the burden of your knowledge to some great wandering child, some universal accident that prowls between the worlds, homeless for eternity. I... Go on. Sir, that if, as Reverend Oxley says, all space is one flesh with us, all worlds, suns, creatures, extensions of one ground, one all-encompassing will, then that ghost you speak of, sir, that comet, that great terror-trailing stuff, is but an outmouthing of God, indeed. Would you stand against such breath?
If it wrenched my soul and burnt me blind? Yes.
It is a dumb thing, sir. Mere chemistry, burst out of chaos, now pulled by this tidal star, now hauled by that. As well stop your own heart as try to stop that great pale beating.
But if both stop at once, will not my victory over it loom as large as its victory over me? Small man, large traveling doom, both weigh the same when the scale is death.
In rending it, you rend your own flesh, Captain, which God has lent you.
That flesh offends me. If it is all one, God manifesting himself in minerals, light, motion, dark, or sensible man, if that comet is my sister self, come preening by to try my Job-like patience, was it not blasphemy it first tried out on me? If I am God's flesh, why was I felled, struck blind? No, no, that thing is lost and evil. Its great face hovers the abyss. Behind its mindless glare, I sense that juice which foils the cogs of nightmare and the pit. And whether I see it in hellfire man, cannibal shark, or huge white blinding mask flung down along the stars to frighten men and push them to impulse less than human, more than bones and soul can bear, I must attack. Talk not of blasphemy to me, sir. It tried me first. I want its flesh.
Help us.
He does. If we are his stumps alive, then we sinew his arms seized out to stop that lightier beast. Would you turn from this greatest hunt?
Sir, I am against you, but don't fear me. Let the captain beware of the captain. Beware of yourself. Old man!
Do you know a rocket feeds itself in space? It wallows like a great fish in streams of subatomic life, interstellar minnows, as twere, subliminal seas and roils of energy, like those tides of grit, the tiny particles in Earth's oceans which feed whales. So a rocket dines on radio waves, fierce radiations, cosmic rays, and meteors. It gulps these maniac foods which shriek invisible on the groundless ground. Ever hungry, we searched for banquets of yammering sound.
Queen Elizabeth, your undoubted queen.
And came by accident upon old wits and broadcast dreams of Earth. No sound, they say, is ever truly lost. in electric clouds, all safely trapped, we tuned up echoes of forgotten wars and peaceful summers.
The question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe.
Request slow speed. Now passing space cloud containing radio data for 1938.
Turn away, Radar One.
Sir?
Turn away.
And turn we did from the wandering voices, those lost children of time. And then, a few days later...
Blue alert! All scanning stations!
Beyond belief.
What is it? An ancient moon?
Yes.
From our system?
No.
From another star?
Yes. Torn loose in some accident, traveling all by itself in space.
And covered with towns, cities, ancient gardens. Believe.
Yet there it is.
Terrible. Beautiful. How long do you think this moon, with all its dead cities, has been rushing through space alone? 1,000 years?
1,000 times 1,000. Oh, nothing. The spire. The jeweled windows. Lonely courts.
Retrograde rocket! Stand by all hands to diminish speed.
Disregard. Continue course.
Captain! Sir, we saw.
Mr. Redley, who commands this rocket?
Why,
did I give orders for reconnaissance?
I quite forgot myself. This moon is very old and fine. Our job's to touch down on such worlds, photograph, record.
Yes, I think. Lovely. Passing strange, there was a time when I...
Our job lies elsewhere. Press on!
Well, there it goes, that moon. The incredible cities.
I shall not see its like again. Lost.
Lost.
If on Earth it is a rare thing for two ships to pass each other on their trips, think what small chance there is for rockets to cross paths in the billion times greater sea of space. Yet pass they sometimes do.
Lightfall 1, calling Cedar 7. Lightfall here, inbound for 12 years' travel, back from the Pyramids Cluster. Shall we hang fire, Cedars? Fix crews and drink a celebration?
Yes, sir.
We shall not.
Do I read you right?
You read me right or wrong. Stand up. Goodbye.
No sooner fleeing one than we came upon another, sadder rocket full of men.
Rachel, it's Captain. Calling Captain of the Cetus there. Have you seen a small life rocket craft? A space storm took it off. We paced that comet.
Comet? What? Leviathan?
Leviathan, yes. My son, oh God, was curious. He took the life raft out to search the comet's wake. Now I search for him. Will you help?
I'm losing time, sir.
Why? I've lost my very life.
I go to redeem your son. God help you, Captain.
God forgive. Master of the Cetus Seven.
So the Rachel, mourning for its lost children, fell away. And we moved toward collision course with annihilation.
Rogers, Smith, Quayle,
Mr. Redley, why all the secrecy?
There's your reason. The captain outside again.
under the stars.
I'd like a stroll myself.
I do not speak on strolls at odd night hours, Mr. Smith. I speak on information we let pass, lost moons we left behind, jobs we did not do.
This comet's a job. We measure all that comes our way.
Measure with man.
Mr. Redley.
Well?
Now what?
Well?
I do read minds. Let my mind gather yours and move outside to stand watch.
I leave a track down a wall of space, and space moves in to rub that white track out with meteor dust and worse with Neptune. Well, let nothing do its worst. I pass. I make my mark.
Mr. Redley.
I protest.
Yes.
All's white or dark. Stars or nebulae as black as ink. From squids which scuttle down a blind god's back. Light, dark, but how we do prefer the first. For white our negro souls much thirst. For such a white as this, though, terrifies. For was it not such all-encompassed white which thrust to panic out my eyes and would have quenched my soul had I not hid it safe away between calamities in nightmare's crib? I did. I thrived on simple crusts of dark and waited out the cyclings of time to bring you round and back again, O whiteness there. My pale and wandering dread stand forth. This time I will not swerve. My path is fixed beyond the gravities. Tracked like the whirls that hurl about the sun, so runs my soul in one trajectory. Blind, my body aches in place of eyes. I'll darken you who darkened me. Your veil will be your winding sheet. Your gossamer I'll bind, strangle you, and thus bank down the fire.
Gentlemen.
Unlawful, uncommon eavesdropping.
Upon uncommon dangers. The captain breaks a higher law.
Would you mutiny, sir?
To save lives, yes.
At ease, the captain blind sees everything you miss. As for those thoughts of his which we just borrowed... Why, how do they differ from ours, which we tell no one? All men are poets in their souls, ashamed to speak it out. Judge thoughts? No, action!
And action now means juggling that fine great fireball comet.
Excuse, Mr. Redley?
Excused. And damned.
By night, I totted up my list of growing fears. The radio voices spurned. The strange moon shunned. The celebration of two rockets passing in the long night refused. And the urgent need of a captain searching for his lost son ignored as if unheard. And then, most frightening of all... within. The music played.
He grew so still, I feared his breath had stopped. He heard his own funeral dirge rolled down the shores of space to end his life. It's over, Quill. He rose to find our metal worker.
Sir?
Cut and weld and shape me a suit of death. I'll draw it for you. So, all black. And on the breastplate of this
coffin,
burn this sign. My family. My world.
You look fine. You don't really think.
I do not think. I know. Make the suit of dark metal.
Quell did not move. He sat by the great star scanning port, his gaze fixed beyond Andromeda, as if he plumbed the fathoms of his own grave and found there all our graves in mutual keep. Quell, taller, stronger, more human than all human men, yet knew his Achilles' heel, but lodged most sadly in the circle of his ear, where the funeral tune of his father's father wrapped him in winding sheets of sound beyond my threats and pleas. Quell. Quell. Meanwhile, the metal worker cut and burnished the uniform all black, which Quell would wear in death.
Red alert! Space storm ahead! White terror, the rushing comet approached. But first it sends a messenger ahead to warn us off. A storm of gravity, atomic whirlwinds, cosmic explosions, and warpings of space which wrecked our ship.
Captain, permission to turn back. We'll be destroyed.
We do not turn. It's testing us.
Head on, Mr. Medley. Head on.
Storm, it's vanished.
Captain, the comet Leviathan. It's disappeared too.
Vanished? Disappeared?
Quell, you're awake again. Oh, Quell, what happened?
He has come round. Quell, what in God's name?
The funeral music gone. Our traveling burial grounds gone. The comet, the nightmare, all gone.
Yes, but why?
The storm has twisted time.
A warp in space?
We've turned a corner in eternity. The storm has thrown us back to another year.
What year?
Who's to tell? Before the wars? Before your Caesar built a Roman road through Britain's moors? The great star beast, it pities us.
No! No, I say! Ridley, the radio telescope.
The comet is not there, sir.
The airlock, open it. Blind, I'll find for myself.
Our captain stood outside on a rocket ship becalmed in peace. It was indeed a time between. And Redley stood with him between the stars. Well, what are they saying?
This and
peace and mild, mild weather. Gone. All the fury. All the burning whiteness. Gone.
Captain, it's given us a last chance to escape.
Escape to what? To land back on Earth and be greeted by Charlemagne, to watch Caesar fall down dead in the forum?
God, give me strength to pull this trigger.
Mr. Redley, you lack the power to fire that gun.
And if I could, how fine to land back home and go with simple caveman in a cave. Live out a life much less a nightmare than all this. To rest a while.
We shall rest, Mr. Redley, at the dead heart of the comet. We shall fight free of this calm, rejoin time on a proper footing, seek, and finally destroy.
Oh, Lord, if I were sure of murdering you as you of murdering it, which will at last do murder to us all.
The sweet calm was over. We fought the storm of time in space and freed ourselves of Roman legions on a dark moor wilderness, lost Waterloo, missed final chance to watch Napoleon soldiers pop the Sphinx's old Egyptian face with rifle fire, and broke free to find the comet.
There. I feel it. It is there. Yes. Is it?
It is.
All hands stand by the emergency life rocket craft. You know the engines of destruction there. In each I've built a sweeping hunger to devour that thing. A beam more powerful than any laser ever built. Wider, longer, swifter. Use that power. Worry the beast. Lay him to waste.
The comet approached, and it was a great white holy terror that filled up all the universe and put out every star. And Quell awakened from his trance, and every man of proper will dropped their masks and took on madness. All human flesh was gone. Red blood was all that moved our ship. The comet loomed. We ran as children run to happy games.
Lifecraft one, launch! Lifecraft two, launch! Mr. Redley, take command. This rocket is yours. Boy, stay behind. Quell, you come with me.
Quell, you put on that black metal.
Suit, yes, with the death symbols on it.
Let me go with you.
Stay and live.
You will live, I know, to be very old. Be happy, Ishmael. Good friend. Goodbye.
Oh, Quell.
We moved. The three small lifeships moved. To cross that moving path of raw destruction, all was white now. We fell as in the great mouth of the sun. Quell.
I hear you, friend.
What will be killed on us? Destroy! Destroy! Destroy!
Destroy and be destroyed. Like mice who nibble at one wave of milky sea, the laser beams all shrieking, but made small by greater shrieks of lightier maddened beasts now gone insane. The comet swept them up and turned them round about in time. The first storm seemed the merest bubble burst upon the edge of greater hurricanes of interstellar night. The ships now, one by one, fell down. Plucked free of skins, their metal skeletons revealed, the men tossed out in mill-race radiation. Flashing meteors eroded, baked, swallowed, vanished in the all-encompassing light. Each man thrown to a different warp in time. In life Warcraft one, their weapons still. Hurled down to death, perhaps, and burials with King Richard on his plane, the crown lost at his feet. The Merman Lifecraft, too, spun further on to drop in open grave with Yorick's skull, or near the tomb in Illinois where Lincoln dreamt away. I do not know. The captain lost. Through Quell, I heard his cry.
What do the weapons gone, my men dispersed? Why then I have these hands? Blind I see on you. Gone dead I grapple you. Where's your heart? There I'll die for it. Oh, damn the Leviathan. It comes to this.
I was tossed forth myself. Alone I watched as now at last the whiteness went its way. With gibbering voice off down the long black mineshaft of the universe, its bridal veil trailing despairs and woes, celebrating itself, a mindless mystery forever in motion. Vanishing. An echo. Gone. And gone all ships, men, large, small, sane or mad, the captain with them, madness maddened. And for a billion years I knew that Leviathan on return, circling round, would bring back with it him who would have done it unto death. The two of them were one at last, the hunter and the hunted, the fearer and the feared, the flesh and the impaler of the flesh, the madness and the vaulting dream of madness, together forever through centuries yet unborn. Ships, men, and the captain of the men. An endless cortege for the spectre ghost. Alone, I floated on a coffin which came under my hands. Within the metal case, dear Quell was buried dead and still. I drifted so upon this strange life raft among the stars for timeless days, until a rocket passing picked me up at last. It was the Rachel, who in her long search for her missing children found but another orphan. I let the coffin go. I let Quell travel on his light year burial ground. The drama's done. The great shroud of stars rolls over the ship, her crew, as the whiteness departs all the way. I, Ishmael, remain to tell you this.
Leviathan 99, a radio drama, was written by Ray Bradbury. The electronic music was composed and executed in stereophony by Tristram Carey. You heard Dennis Hawthorne as Ishmael, who told the story, and Christopher Lee as the captain. Robert Edison as Quell, Walter Fitzgerald as the Warning Man, and Dennis McCarthy as Father Ellery Colworth. Alexander John as the first mate of the Cetus VII, and Ian Thompson, Anthony Jackson, Christopher Bidmead, Nigel Clayton, and Leroy Lingwood as members of the crew. Frank Henderson as Lightfall One's captain, and Rafe Truman as the Rachel's captain. Technical direction was by Harry Catlin. And the play was adapted for stereophony and produced by H.B. Fortine.
So there you go. There's Leviathan 99 by Ray Bradbury from the BBC radio. I will say I enjoyed this a lot more on my second listening. The first time through, I just had a really hard time not picturing all these men on a boat, like I was watching or listening to Moby Dick, you know, with on the sea with the sails. You know, I've seen enough of that imagery and seen that portrayed enough that that's what I was envisioning. It was hard for me to envision them in a spaceship. So hopefully my little warning at the beginning prepared you for that, and hopefully you thought of this in more of a science fiction setting, because that's what it was meant to be. And you know, you have a telepath alien with many arms. It looks different than a human. We have an android kind of robot guy. You know, we're out in space chasing a comet. But yeah, see, you know, the space has always been, or I should say, the sea has always been a good metaphor for space. You know, and your spaceships being sailing ships out on the sea. I mean, that metaphor is almost baked into classic science fiction, right? Oh, let's tell that same story, only we're in space. And, you know, when you drill all this down, that's basically what this is. Moby Dick in space. You know, that's the gist of it. And so, but I thought it was interesting, you know, the main protagonist, you know, our first person narrative, the guy was named Ishmael, just like in Moby Dick. But we never got a name for the captain, Christopher Lee, I guess you could call him, Captain Lee. So we didn't have Ahab in here. And then, you know, obviously some of the characters came through from Moby Dick with different names and, of course, you know, alien beings. And so, yeah, I think it's very interesting. Like I said in the beginning, this narrative must have really stuck in his mind, and Bradbury must have really have seen this as a great translation for science fiction. This was later in his career, right? This wasn't one of his first, you know, Martian Chronicles type stories. He'd been around for a while. I think he wrote the screenplay for the movie like soon after Fahrenheit 451 had been published, and he was, you know, receiving critical acclaim for that. I think, you know, it just really must have stuck in his mind, and he wanted to work out how this would work as a science fiction epic. You know, I thought the production of this, especially the beginning of the episode, was a little too much, a little overwrought, overdone. But maybe that was just me acclimating to the way that the BBC was telling this story and the sound effects and the production that they put into it. I guess they really were trying to establish that this was not the sea. You know, the music was kind of old 60s. You know, this was 68, right? So late 60s sci-fi type stuff. Yeah, I just felt this was really interesting, you know, that especially that this was written as a radio play. You know, the late 60s radio, especially radio drama, I should say, was on its way out. You know, there were some hangers-on and some fringe things, you know, people trying to revitalize. At least in America, the old-time radio drama was pretty much going the way of all the earth. Maybe not so much in England, I'm not sure. But like I said, this was a very literary piece. And so, you know, the BBC actually felt like the right place for it. I thought Christopher Lee as the captain was interesting. You know, sometimes when you're, well, obviously when you're seeing him in a movie, you recognize him. And sometimes I can recognize his voice in this. But in the same way, you know, I think he can really be a chameleon with his voice, and you don't know that it's Christopher Lee. If I hadn't told you that that's who it was, I wonder if you would have picked it out. Something I forgot to tell you before the episode started was that Christopher Lee was really instrumental in making this happen. He was friends with Ray Bradbury. And when Bradbury was having a hard time selling this as a radio play to American networks, I think it was NBC, Christopher Lee said, hey, why don't I take this and share it with the BBC and try to get something going with that? And with his endorsement and agreement to play the captain in this, you know, I think that went a long ways to selling it to the BBC. You know, Bradbury was really a fan of storytelling in general. He loved the cinema. He loved poetry. He loved classic literature. He loved, obviously, radio plays, right? Many of his stories were adapted to radio plays, and I think he wrote several tales as radio plays originally. But yeah, this kind of reminds me of the story around Something Wicked This Way Comes, where, you know, he had this short story called Black Ferris, and he was trying to get it adapted into a movie for Gene Kelly. He loved Gene Kelly and wanted to create something with him, you know, make a movie with him as the lead character. And that's kind of where the Something Wicked This Way Comes started. And so that kind of reminds me of that with Christopher Lee going to BBC and selling it as a radio play. Apparently this was also done as a stage play at some point. And then eventually he worked it into a novel. Never, you know, before I ran across this audio production, I never knew that he had written this Leviathan 99. It was kind of a revelation to me. It's like, oh, I've never heard of that. This is a Bradbury thing? I thought it was like a novel that was adapted into the radio play, but no, it's the opposite. He originally wrote it as a radio play and then adapted it into a novel. But I guess I'm just repeating myself at this point, so I should probably let you go. But if you'd like to comment on this episode or any other things that I put out here on the podcast, feel free to contact me at journeyintopodcast@gmail.com. If you'd like to support the podcast and get early and extra stuff here from not only these journeys, but a lot of other stuff on the Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/journeyinto. There's, of course, different levels of support that you can get different things over there. So go check that out. And yeah, sorry this took so long to get to you, but I'll be back next month with another journey. But until then, stay safe out there and journey on. The Journey Into podcast is produced under Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License, which means that you are encouraged to share this podcast with as many people as you would like. But please don't change it or sell it, and let people know where you got it from.